It's time for three stories you should know.
I want to thank the front office, the ownership, for believing in me. And I was 18 years old back in Greece.
That's Milwaukee Bucks forward Giannis Antetokounmpo speaking after he was named the NBA's most valuable player on Monday. And that's where we'll start this week. I'm joined by Professor Kenneth Shropshire, CEO of Arizona State University's Global Sport Institute. Welcome back, Ken.
Thank you, Karen.
And by Mike Pesca, host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist. Welcome back, Mike.
Thanks for having me. We're also global. Just wanted to make that clear.
Ken, I'm turning it over to you.
Well, this week I'm looking at the progression of the NBA's journey to globalization, something we've been hearing about forever. And this week we saw Giannis, the Nigerian from Greece, winning the MVP award. Rookie of the Year, we have a Serbian, Luka Doncic. Mrs. Clemente, my high school French teacher, helps me with the rest. The Defensive Player of the Year, Rudy Gobert. And then the Most Improved Player, Pascal Siakam from Cameroon and Gobert from France. And let us not forget that the championship of the league is now Toronto. This really, to me, is a turning point where it's not just a novelty.
It's a great point, and this clean sweep of the major award by international players is a fascinating development. Foreign-born players have won the MVP before, Hakeem Olajuwon and Dirk Nowitzki, and two-time MVP Steve Nash, a Canadian and a South African.
That's right.
Basketball is a fun game, an aesthetically appealing game, and I could see why the world would love it. But why is it that more so than any other American sport, it attracts international talent? And I have this theory, which is that readily to the eye, it is quite easy to salivate and get excited about potentially good basketball players insofar as that they are tall. They are sometimes in the 0.5% of the population. And I just think that in other sports, it's less easy.
You can't coach height.
Exactly. There is no doubt that basketball is becoming more international, and I'm a big fan of that. But, you know, Commissioner Adam Silver has said that he thinks basketball can become the number one sport in the world, and that just kind of seems crazy to me. Ken, do you think basketball will ever catch up to the sport the rest of the world calls football?
No, nor cricket. I mean, you know, it's not a game that has a deep history in countries in the way that soccer has a deep history just about everywhere in the world.
All right. The IOC has announced new reforms to the Olympic bid process. In the past, reforms have attempted to make hosting the games more affordable. These reforms focus on, among other things, making sure that host cities have public support. And that seems logical and important. But do not be fooled. The IOC hasn't developed a sudden concern for taxpaying citizens. No. As Australian IOC member John Coates put it, quote, "We can't continue to be damaged as we have been in the past." He's referring to the trend of cities starting to bid for the games only to drop out due to a lack of local support. You may remember Boston's brief 2024 bid. And I'm left wondering, is there anything in these reforms that is actually going to make things better for bid cities? Or is it all about making things better for the IOC?
You know, I read that and understand it to be more of a slow walk process. It's not going to be a situation anymore where we look for the best deal at that moment. But we're going to massage and work with several venues and see how well they do. So they're actually in some ways extending the competition in a way that they haven't done before. So the whole magic envelope and, you know, Obama flying in for 2 hours, which wasn't long enough, that event, you know, they're trying to do away with it. And also, too, I think it's they're trying to push away from that somebody loses kind of moment. This is part of the everybody gets a trophy kind of aura.
I think that it would be wrong to see the IOC as being proactive. They're really being reactive. For a while, there were no bids for one of the Winter Olympics. And it's been pretty clear for a while that the only kind of countries that are interested in bidding for the Olympics are totalitarian regimes, or at least oppressive regimes, who could use them to burnish their credentials.
Wait, wait, LA 2028? Come on, man.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to cast aspersions on Mr. Garcetti yet. But the point is, if you are an autocrat, the Olympics are so much more attractive to you And Thomas Bach knows this, and he's an Olympian and not only head of the IOC, and it bothers him. But they also have this structure where the first, second, third through 10th thing that has to be satisfied is that all the money sloshing around goes to the right people. So it's a really bad situation that I think there's no coming back from the brink with, and this is just tinkering on the edges.
I got to say, Mike, I had the same sort of reaction to you. I thought, okay, so the IOC is going to be going into these countries with sort of no history with democracy, like no dissent. And they're going to be asking people, do you support this? And they're going to say, yes, because that's the only answer that's allowed, you
right,
know?
Right, right, right. It'll look like a Saddam Hussein re-election campaign.
All right, Mike, you're up.
Well, golf is, I would say, just about my least favorite sport. It is the elitism. It is the elitism that bothers me. And in The New Yorker, Nick Paumgarten wrote just a fantastic piece called Inside the Cultish Dream World of Augusta National. And there are points in the New Yorker story when they clarify phrases like, talk about Tiger Woods, he had his driver out, the club that hits the ball the farthest, the one you use off the tee. And so to me, Augusta, being so particular and so fussy and so elitist about some of its phrases, is exactly like The New Yorker, which is a magazine I love, you know, still using the two dots over cooperate. It's not an umlaut. What is that? I don't want to say diuretic because I'm not an elitist.
Is this where I get to bring up the time when you were forced to explain what a three-point shot was?
Yes, an early NPR editor thought to clarify that.
Ken, what do you make of this?
Well, I sacrilegiously listened to the New Yorker article shortly after I saw the piece on the Red Sox flying to London in this charter crystal sky luxury jet thing. All this stuff was just a reminder as I near retirement age that I haven't made it. I mean, the article was talking about, you know, the pimento sandwiches and the greens with the pipes underneath, all this stuff that is just so far out of the realm of normalcy. Whatever you think about Bernie Sanders, I mean, he keeps raising it. There is this 1% that's got some things that most of us have not a clue about. And that's what that article did for me.
Yeah, I really couldn't decide what my favorite details from the story were. I mean, it's certainly not new news that Augusta is the epicenter for privilege, but this sort of detail on what is going on there really, to me, was incredibly interesting, Mike.
Oh, my God. I can report with confidence that it's called the diuresis. I did look that up.
Thank goodness.
Yeah. Ken, when you talk about the 1%, this is really the 0.01%.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not a takedown. It's not an expose. It's just a glimpse into this hidden Shangri-La. And the thing that it reminds me most, I just read this excellent biography of Kim Jong-un, which is to say, wow, that's crazy.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Kenneth Shropshire, CEO of Arizona State University's Global Sport Institute, and Mike Pesca, host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.